Well, I'm going to gavel us in to start. First of all, I'm going to apologize right off the top, and that is this is my first meeting as a chair, so I'm a little, this is new to me. I've watched other people do it, so this is going to be interesting to see, or at least I think I will be chair. I want to thank you all for being here. We have a couple quick things that we need to do that are classic committee meeting things to do, so let's, why don't we start off with that. I have asked a motion to nominate the chair.
Representative Frederick, I'd like to nominate you as the chair.
Does that require a second?
Thank you. Okay, I guess.
Any other nominations?
If not, then thank you. I will accept that as the chair.
Any objections?
Any objections? No? Okay.
Not yet.
Thank you. I'm sure that there will be something at some point. Thank you. And now we need to adopt the committee rules. I think you have those. They are not the normal rules that we have.
To adopt, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do I need a second? All those in favor of the any objections to that? Adopting the rules? Then that's what we'll do.
So we don't need to second it if he wants to adopt his rules?
No. Okay, so what I'd like first for folks to do is to introduce themselves. So if you wouldn't mind, Tricia, to start off.
I'm Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. We are predominantly classified school employees working in K-12 school districts throughout the state. And I also represent OSEA on the Department of State Lands Beneficiaries Advisory Group and have a very strong interest in protecting the Common School Fund.
I'm Drew Johnston. I am Legislative Director for State Treasurer Ted Wheeler, so I serve here as his designee on the task force. I'm also a land board assistant, so connected to the state lands in that way as well.
I'm Matt DeVore, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Justice and the Contact Counsel for the State Land Board and the Department of State Lands.
I'm Mary Abrams. I'm the Director of the Department of State Lands.
I'm Laura Lockwood McCall. I am the Public Finance Representative on the Commission. My day job is the Director of Debt Management for the Oregon State Treasury.
Thank you all for being here. Rod Monroe was hoping to be here. He's not going to be able to make it. He's having some tests done, so he wanted me to send his regrets. I talked with him yesterday. Looking forward to having him working with us on this. I wanted to just, if you don't mind, just sort of give you a sense of where this began. What I've been trying to work on for some time is the ability to clean up brownfields. In my district, there are 147 of them. Actually, will soon be 146. One of them is my favorite brownfield is being cleaned up soon, although sometimes, you know, you have to be careful what you wish for, because in fact it's now going to be a six-story building, which is not something the neighbors are particularly interested in. Thank you. So I have, there are brownfields in every district, and they're about that equivalent number in every district across the state, which most folks don't recognize. They're the old gas stations, the dry cleaners, the battery companies, the mechanic shops, the farm supply systems, all of those places have brownfields, and everyone I talk with wants to have some way of cleaning them up, because then they are sitting there often. That's my brownfield, is the one that I keep looking at, has been there for about 30 years now, just empty, and an eyesore. So we were alerted to the idea that the statutory Common School Fund is an investment fund, and one that supports the Common School Fund with this investment income, and could be possibly deployed in this way. This proved to be significantly more complicated than anticipated. But I really want to thank Mary Abrams and the Department of State Lands for helping us explain that. By the way, I also want to thank the Department of State Lands and the Treasury for being the stewards, the excellent stewards of these funds. So the question changed. And now, instead of asking whether this money could be invested in brownfield development, we're asking for a more basic question. Could it be invested in a way that not only produces investment income for the Common School Fund, but also produces local or in-state economic activities with larger in-state economic benefits? If the answer is yes, there is that potential, then loans for brownfield development might be one of those ways. And I believe an explanation of this kind, I believe we can also be open to the possibility that the answer is no. So we need to be aware of that. I think especially, though, that if we can do it without compromising our returns, we should also be ever vigilant for ways to use state funds to support our local businesses and our communities. So with that, I hope Director Abrams can give us some baseline information we need about how these funds work and what the current rules are.
Yes, so I think, Victoria, did you produce copies of this?
Isn't it in your packets there?
Oh, there is. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, so I just have an overview that I was going to walk through, and then we have this graphic that we use for the Common School Fund just to explain it to folks, because it is a little bit complicated. And I want to start by saying that although we got this task force started talking about the statutory Common School Fund, there really is no such thing as a statutory Common School Fund. There is a Common School Fund, and it has monies that were generated from constitutional revenues and money that was generated from statutory revenues, and they go together to make the Common School Fund. So it's a little bit of a misnomer to talk about it, and I just didn't catch that when we were putting together the task force language. But I think the real goal is to talk about the statutory component. The constitutional component of the Common School Fund is very clearly laid out in the Constitution and in a variety of statutes that money is there to maximize investment gains in order to provide money for the schools. And so it has a very dedicated purpose. There's been a lot of case law around the western states in particular where these funds are common that has found that the funds that are put together for based on the lands that were given at statehood need to be dedicated to the common schools or to the beneficiaries. Some states have beneficiaries that were designated differently in their constitution, but in Oregon it was clearly the Common School Fund. So that limits how much can be used, and because we have an investment approach to the funds in the Common School Fund, we actually are making quite good returns on those, somewhere upwards, sort of depends on which period you choose, but it can be as high as 13% for a period of time. I think that's the five-year average at this point. The one-year average is lower, of course, and then we had a period of time when it was quite a bit lower during the recession. But all in all, over the years, it has always been pretty good. We've grown the fund from about 1.4, I want to say, in 2008 from 700 in 2008 to 1.4 currently. And so you can see that the investment that's done by the investment board, the treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council are the ones that manage those investments. And they've made a very good return on those investments. So for the constitutional funds that go into the Common School Fund, those funds, it's pretty clear from a legal standpoint that they need to be used in a way that would maximize their return for the common schools. There's also, and in the handout that you have, it talks about the revenues that come into the Common School Fund from Article 8. Section 2 of the Constitution, and they include the timber sale receipts, so that's the money that we get off of our forest lands, which unfortunately has been significantly lower in the recent past. Revenues from virtually all of our range and agricultural lands, so we have about 625,000 acres of rangeland out in the eastern part of the state and agricultural lands that are commingled with them, and the revenues from them are constitutional. The lease and parking fee income from our own DSL building, so we own the building but not the land, that's a DASP property. And then clear proceeds from any escheated property, so estates, people who die without a will and without heirs, that money is escheated to the state, and by Article 8 goes into the Common School Fund. And then any hard rock mineral revenues from the constitutional lands, so the mineral rights for hard rock minerals under the constitutional lands. And we do have one active mining adventure for hard rock minerals, so we do actually have some revenues. The statutory component, so there are a number of statutes that over the years where programs have been assigned to the Department of State Lands, and any revenues from those activities have been directed to the Common School Fund as well. And so the revenues, the actual direct revenues from sources other than the constitutional lands that go into the Common School Fund are statutory, and these include the leases, easements, registrations on submerged and submersible lands. So it's always a little confusing to people because at statehood we also got ownership of the submerged and submersible lands, but they are not considered constitutional lands because they didn't come in as a part of the Constitution. They came in under what is called the equal footing doctrine, which meant that as the 13 states, original states, took on the legal doctrine, if you will, from Great Britain, which said that all navigable waterways belong to the state, in that case the Crown, but for the 13 original colonies that became the first part of the U.S., that was those navigable waters were given to each of the states. So as each additional state came in to the Union, they were granted the same equal footing, if you will, under the law, which was the title to the submerged and submersible lands. So even though they came in at the time of statehood, they're not considered constitutional lands. They're considered statutory lands. We also were given in the 1960s, we were given the removal fill program. We're always happy to give it away again if anybody wants it, but nobody seems to want it. And we do get permit fees and civil penalties from that program. However, the revenues in that program only pay for about 20% of the program, and the other 80% comes out of the Common School Fund. So that's not really a high performer. The wetland delineation fees, similarly, we pay for one position out of our in-lieu fee program, and other than that, the money is made up for by the Common School Fund. And then any clear proceeds from forfeitures that come to the state are statutorily directed to the State Land Board. There's one other piece of money, lump of money, that goes into the Common School Fund that's statutory in nature, and that's the unclaimed property that the state holds in perpetuity for the owners while we go out and look for owners. And so these aren't really considered revenues because they're not money, they're not the state's money. It's just money that we're holding for the rightful owners. Those receipts are a significant portion of the Common School Fund. They currently make up about half of the Common School Fund. And so they're a really important component of how much we can distribute each year to the schools. So they're not minor to the success of the Common School Fund at this point in time. We, as I said, we don't consider these to be revenue. We don't own the property or the money that's generated from that property when we auction it. Rather, we're just the custodian of that money. However, those funds are deposited into the Common School Fund and used as part of their, and invested just like the other parts of the Common School Fund, and the earnings, therefore, are part of the distribution to the schools. I wanted to talk a little bit about expenses too, because that's the revenue side of thing, and then there things, and then there's the expenses side. So we have the constitutional revenues that come in, and we actually pay for any expenses that are incurred for the operation and management of constitutional lands or other lands that are managed by the land board, and that includes the submerged and submersible lands. And so we actually pay for a good portion of our waterways program through the constitutional revenues, and it's a good thing because the statutory revenues wouldn't cover them all. We do have an increased burden on the statutory portion of the Common School Fund, if you look at it that way, which is the Portland Harbor, which, because of our ownership of the submerged and submersible lands, we have a role to play as a potential responsible party in that discussion for the, and that's like the mega brownfield, if you will. And so we have through...
Fun site?
Pardon?
Is it a Superfund site?
It's a Superfund site, yes, that's correct. And we have both the proprietaries, the ownership side of that, and then places where we have given leases to people, and they have, you know, managed property in a way that contributed. So we have both potentially as just the owner of the property, and then as the person that leased the property to someone who might have done something that contributed to the contamination. And so that's a long ongoing project. We've paid $2 million just this year.
$2 million.
I'm just looking at Cindy Wickham, who is the expert on all things here. $2 million just this year on Portland Harbor expenses. And we do have some insurance policies, fortunately for the state, that are paying a portion of that, but not all of it. And it's very unclear. And this is just the forensics for developing our legal case for the Portland Harbor. It's very unclear how the actual damages that are assessed against the state will be paid. And that's a conversation that has yet to play out. Whether that will come, you know, people will think it needs to come from the Common School Fund, or whether the state as a whole will be taking on that responsibility. So that's a major problem for the Common School Fund at this point, is sort of the uncertainty and the actual expenses that are associated with the Portland Harbor Superfund site. We also have had in the past year or two some significant drops in the forest revenues because of the threatened and endangered species issues on the Elliott State Forest in particular, which is our sort of major contributor to the forest revenues. And that has caused us to really have a decrease in actual contributions to the Common School Fund over the last few years. And so currently what we're seeing is that we have both the impact of the Portland Harbor, which has become more expensive to be dealing with, the decrease in our revenues from the Common School Fund, and actually an increase in our ability to find the rightful owners for unclaimed property, which is a good thing, especially if you're an owner of unclaimed property. You're happy that we find you. But all of those three components pulled together really actually put us in the red for actual contributions, net revenue into the Common School Fund, other than the investment earnings. And so that's why the investment earnings to us are so important and so critical. And it's also why the unclaimed property program is very important to us, because it provides us with one of the few places where we're continuing to get money flowing into the fund. So that's sort of the status, and I hope maybe I'm open to answer questions that people might have to better understand how the program works. If you look at the graphic, you can see how the constitutional revenues and the statutory revenues flow into the Common School Fund. We were just saying the other day that that's a little erroneous right now, because the constitutional revenue should be quite a bit smaller, and the statutory revenue and the unclaimed property in particular, statutory revenue should remain pretty small, and then the unclaimed property, which just sort of is an afterthought in that program, in that depiction, is our major contributor at this point in time. And then you can see that the capital improvement and maintenance is paid off of the corpus, the lake, if you will, of the Common School Fund, and so are the constitutional and unclaimed property expenses. And then the distribution to schools goes off to the right. We try and pay the statutory expenses what we can out of the statutory revenue before it goes into the corpus. So it turns out, and if you look over time at the amount of net actual monies that go in from the statutory programs, not counting the unclaimed property, it bounces around between maybe a few million net to a few million under the expenses. So it just depends a little bit on what's happening. And again, Portland Harbor plays a major role in that. So that's the state of things. Now, Cindy, if there's anything else I should add.
So.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mary, will you say that last part again? You were saying that the bottom line for statutory revenue is either a few million above line
zero, or
a few million in
under
red. So there's
depending
not
on the
really
year.
Any dependable large amount of money there
from the revenues themselves. And what people, I mean, I'm going to be very frank in these meetings, because I think it's important to acknowledge, this question comes up a lot, and that's what I said to Representative Frederick when we were talking about this in the last session. And I think it's important to really nail down what we're talking about. So what happens is people talk about it as statutory revenue, but in fact what they have their eyes on is the unclaimed property pool. And that is not truly revenue. So if you look at the revenue, what comes in versus what gets spent on the statutory revenue side, it bounces around somewhere right around zero, depending on how many expenses we have, particularly associated with Portland Harbor, or how, you know, how many fines, and in good economic times we get a lot more revenue in terms of our removal fill program, because people are constructing and building more, and we also get a lot more lease activity on the waterways. And so in those more economically robust times, we generally see a little bit of a boost in it. But generally there's not much to skim off.
That's a good question. Yes. So the corpus of this unclaimed property earns money.
Yes.
Does that go eventually to the unclaimed property person who owns it?
No, it goes to the...
So the only thing you really get off of it is any interest earnings.
Yes.
Capital gains mm-hmm. off of
right.
the corpus of that.
Right.
And could you sort of tell me roughly how much money spins off of that overall corpus that goes to common schools?
We're doing about $50 million a year, so $100 million a biennium.
And that's from all the revenue sources.
That's from all of the revenue sources. And the way that's calculated is the 3-year running average of the interest earnings. Is that correct?
So that way
market
you don't
value, sorry,
give them a big bump and then if the market turns
yeah.
down.
4% of the 3-year average of the market value.
4%. So it's like an endowment.
Yes, it's just like an endowment. And that's the way we try to manage it, because as the Constitution lays it out, these monies are not just for one generation of common school kids, or they would have just taken the money and built all the schools
right.
and be done with it. But instead, what they said is this is for current and future generations. And so the land board, which Drew is representing, their goal is really to have an intergenerational endowment for the schools. And of course, our intention is to grow that as much as we can. We've faced quite a few challenges to that recently. But we still believe that there are ways to work through this and get back into the track of contributing significantly to the school budget. So that's, any other questions?
Well, because I knew nothing about this, you know, one of the, just for maybe for the record,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the stocks and bonds that are in the fund, the way they're invested, talked to Mike Mueller,
yeah.
who does a lot with it. So he talked about that OIC has 70% of this invested more or less in stocks,
mm-hmm.
and then 30% is in fixed income.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that's a useful
yeah.
parameter as well for folks to get. And as you said, the 5-year average return has been
yes.
north of 13%.
Yeah. Which I would love to have been, personally. But
I believe the fixed income is much lower than that.
Right.
If
they had some good years in fixed income, because interest rates are dropping, so you can get capital gains
mm-hmm.
off of managing it. So he actually said it was about 8%.
Yes.
For that part of the portfolio.
Let me go back again. You said 70%
in stocks.
Stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And 30%
in
fixed income.
But I think the relevant thing is even the fixed income portion, which is more akin to doing like a loan,
right.
has been earning 8%. And so when you think about for businesses or communities who might use the funds, 8% is a fairly high rate of cost of funds in our current interest rate
mm-hmm.
environment, which is really where it's headed.
Right.
Well, I wanted to thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions? We have a pretty straightforward statement here. The task force number 2. Task force shall identify opportunities for making loans from the Common School Fund for the purpose of financing projects that provide significant in-state economic benefits. That's
mm-hmm.
that's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have very little time to do that.
Right.
So let's be clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
Um, The opportunities that we initially talked about, as I said, one of the things that I was looking at was in terms of how we could invest in terms of brownfields. The six-story building that's being built on that property will be an investment, but it may be not what the neighbors want. Interestingly enough, it's on the edge of one neighborhood association, edge of two neighborhood associations, and the one neighborhood association that is most upset about it is not in charge of that particular plot of land. But it is an investment, and it's something that we are looking at. I don't anticipate that it's necessarily going to be brownfields, but are there other suggestions on what we could be doing for investing these loans? What kind of opportunities might be there? What we don't want to have is we don't want to be losing any money, because we need to have more money going into the school fund, not less. And that's what I want to see happening. I want to make sure that we're doing it, but I also want hope that we can do it and also have an impact, especially on the communities around communities that, for instance, the brownfields. I think that's one thing. But I keep pushing, going back to that, does not have to be that. If there are other investment ideas that can make money, can make more money for us and be put into the various funds, but certainly we need to have more, certainly not less than what we've had. Yes, Trish.
Mr. Chair, I am not an investment person and I'm not a developer. But I can't understand how it would pencil out that for the Common School Fund to make loans because of the returns on the investments that we have. Who would borrow money at that kind of an interest rate for a project unless it's a project they can't get conventional financing for? And all the other Business Oregon kinds of giveaway programs that we have. Plus the EPA, if we're talking brownfield, has a ton of grants for cities that they are giving right now to identify and develop brownfield sites. So I can't get my head around what type of project could return the kind of money that we would need into the Common School Fund and be stable and sure enough for the Common School Fund that we would be willing to loan the money to that entity. It baffles me, and I can't understand it.
Okay. So if I may...
Yes, please.
If I may give some examples of how this has been done in other states. So the piece that I forgot to sort of go over in great detail is the origin of these constitutional lands, which were given, as I indicated, for specific beneficiaries in each of the western states. And this really started with about Ohio. And from then on, they were giving one section for every township until they got to Oregon, when they gave us two sections for each township, until they got to Arizona and New Mexico, when they gave four townships or sections for every township. And each state in their admissions act set those up to benefit different groups. And each state wrote their constitution to reflect that differently. So you'll see in different places, in different states around the western states, a slightly different approach. And there are some places where they do investments. I don't know any that do brownfields, but I do know there are states such as Arizona that invest in some of the infrastructure for schools. So they give it to schools like we do as a distribution, but they also invest in hard structures for schools. Wisconsin, who only funds construction projects. They don't do a distribution. They just fund construction projects for and it started out just being school construction projects, but then it expanded to taxing authorities that had construction projects. And they have never, in all the time they've been loaning, this was started at statehood for Wisconsin, which was quite a while ago, they've never had a default. Now, that's sort of in the line of the fixed income portion of the investment portfolio, if you will, because that's not going to gain you a lot of money, but it would be a continual, you'd know you'd have a repayment every year. There are states like, there's actually quite a few now, well, I should say several, Idaho, Colorado, Utah, Arizona, and I think New Mexico, who are, and actually Washington State is too, I just found out, are investing in commercial properties. And we have done a little bit of that as the state of Oregon. The risk in doing that, from my perspective, it, particularly for us, with the small amount of land base that we still have left, so I forgot to mention the fact that early on some legislators and the land board apparently were in cahoots to give away or sell a lot of the school common school lands, and so we only have about 20% of the original donation.
How long ago was that?
1900s, early
1900s. Early 1900s, yeah. There was huge fraud.
They went to jail.
Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I recall reading about that. Yeah. And that went back to the federal level as well. Absolutely, yeah.
And so, so for us, we have a pretty small land base now that's still left compared to Washington. I think they have almost an order of magnitude more lands than we have. And so do these other states, and particularly Arizona and New Mexico, because they got four sections for every township. So places where you have a little bit more flexibility and an ability to use the land base in a more creative way, if I can put it that way, have had some success with the commercial investments. And so they would, you know, they would buy an area right on the edge of town and have it incorporated into the town and develop a strip mall. And then depending on which state, some of them actually still run the leases for individual properties. And some of them do the development work itself and then sell the developed parcels, and they don't lease them and manage them themselves. We have been involved on a very small basis here in Oregon with, and primarily not lands that we've purchased, although in a few places we've purchased them, that are, that we purchase from land sales that we've done on our constitutional lands for commercial properties that we assume are going to get a higher rate of return than our forest or our rangeland. And quite frankly, it's sort of a terrifying experience to me, because my department, that's very small and has three staff that are associated with any real estate transactions whatsoever, is out making investment decisions, multi-million dollar investment decisions. And none of them are trained that way. I certainly am not, and I'm asked to sign off on these things. So I've signed off on a grand total of one, and I've stopped at, you know, sort of in a hiatus while we really evaluate whether this is the best way to try and make money. I mean, I just don't know that we, as the Department of State Lands, are set up to be an investment broker. And so, you know, we've stopped that. So if you think about the tradition, if you will, with the state lands, of having lands, if they're not productive, divesting of those and then reinvesting the money in another land base, which is historically what, other than the more criminal aspect, what we've done, that's the sort of thing, sort of an answer to your question, Tricia, that is a possibility, is some way that's a commercial venture investment where you can actually see that you would get, from a development standpoint, the idea is that you get a bunch of money when you sold it. But if you have me making that decision for you, I'm not sure that you're guaranteed.
I know a lot of formerly wealthy developers
exactly.
that are living in what they thought was their second house right now.
Yeah. And we did have a very bad experience because we purchased a lot of lands or exchanged a lot of lands in Central Oregon in 2006, 2007, thinking that the boom was going to last forever. And in 2008, we were all very sorry. And we think we might possibly be at a place where we're going to make a little bit of money off of one of those properties now, and it's 2014. And I'm sure we won't make anything like what was projected at the beginning. So it has the risks of what Tricia points out, unless there's some way to have that investment be stabilized so that it could be part of a fixed income, if you will, kind of approach.
And let me just add, we sell bonds for the state, but also we have a school bond guarantee program in our state. I don't know, they have it in Arizona and elsewhere, but they get, once we have a state aid intercept. Mm-hmm. And so with that intercept feature, we have over $3 billion of public school bonds that have been guaranteed. And they borrow at the same interest rates we borrow at, which right now, if you were to do like a 20, 25-year bond, would be under 4%. So this Common School Fund could loan money to schools instead, but frankly, if they qualify and can borrow at those rates, I don't know, again, if that, you know, in Arizona, they don't have an income tax, so they don't have, our tax exemption makes our tax-exempt bonds a little bit more interesting to investors, but all things being equal, I think it's great to invest in schools, but I don't think you're going to get the 8% rates of return, even and I think it's very stable because it'd all be property tax based.
Right.
So I think that is an area that would be difficult. I will say, not that I'm involved in OIC, but they do have a real estate portfolio as mm-hmm. part of PERS. So,
and we've spoken with them about mm-hmm. that.
But a lot of those investments are outside of Oregon.
Too. Oh my goodness, most of them, because again, the goal is as a fiduciary, you're trying to get the highest rate of return, and that's the core of this, which is a fiduciary goal versus a social or economic goal, and whether you can merge the two in the same fund is tricky and challenging.
And I can recall, because I'm old, a former treasurer being pilloried in the Capitol because of those real estate investments. Made by the land board and the disastrous results of some of them.
Well, I'm hearing two things. One is regarding the school infrastructure, and I was curious a little bit more about that. I'd love to get more information on that. But it's not going to come in at the, as you said, the competition, as you're mentioning, the competition for return is significantly is significant, 4% versus 8%. I mean, that's pretty straightforward there. The commercial properties issue, are there other I'd love to be able to answer your question. I don't know. That's part of the reason why I wanted to have a task force. I don't know about whether there are other commercial possibilities that Business Oregon is not already able to work on and to give loans on. Do you?
I mean, what we have done, did you have something you wanted to add, Drew?
Well, just to that question, I know the Secretary of State's office has been interested, and there's a regional solutions person maybe in Eastern Oregon. Pendleton area has a lot of temporary workers that they'd like to provide more housing for, but there's kind of a gap in their ability to get the financing to do that development. So if you're looking for examples, that's certainly one that, you know, has risen to the top of some concern.
Right.
So.
And what I was going to ask Laura, actually, about that idea was, instead of talking about loaning money directly to someone for workforce housing, one of the conversations had been about, could you be the finance backer, if you will,
The guarantor,
there you go. And I don't know whether there's any money to be made out of that kind of a,
No, I'm going to tell you about some airport hangars.
Yeah.
Oh.
PERS was the guarantor for.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that if the person in front fails, then you're on the hook. And so it goes from being this profit-making opportunity to being a financial drain. And so I think even in that situation, you need to be careful. When I mentioned we do guarantees for school bonds, did I mention we have a state aid intercept?
Yeah.
We've never used it, but the state's basically underwritten and guaranteed billions of dollars, but that's because we know that we would just turn around and take the money from state aid, or we'd have to deal with, you know, the realities of it. So I think you could do it, but you would want fairly sophisticated finance staff to help make sure that all of your legal elements were very protected.
Yeah. And you have to build in an assumption of risk. You know you're going to lose money on some of those projects.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends often on, in addition to the expertise of your staff, just timing and luck.
Yeah.
And this is a fund, the Common School Fund is a trust, and it's never been managed with that kind, or shouldn't, in our opinion, be managed with that kind of risk accepted, because it's a fund that's supposed to exist in perpetuity. And so I think there is a very small measure of risk you should be taking. And the land board has been consistent in that approach.
And we have, when we've made commercial investments, so I've only been involved, like I said, in one, and I've actually turned down a couple of others. But what we've, our goal has been to meet or beat the investment that is being made for the Common School Fund. And we identify and do the projections as best we can, and I think it's not a bad bad methodology, but it's probably not nearly as sophisticated as some of the stuff that gets done in Treasury. For estimating over time lease payments and rents and all that, what could we make? And so, like I said, I purchased one, and which was very far in the works when I got there. So I ended up signing the papers. But we are pretty proud of it because it's doing, well. It's not doing, fabulously, but it's not losing money either, like our forest lands are. So we're happy about that. The downside, we sat down and talked to the real estate people in Treasury who are involved, not here in Oregon. I don't think they have any actual investments here in Oregon. But they just said, that's great, but you actually don't know how well you're doing on your return until you successfully sell that property for a profit. And so we don't really know. We think, we're right here, we're 3 years into it, 2 years into it. We think, oh yeah, this is great, but we actually don't know that at the end of the day it will be a positive for the Common School Fund. So it is very, there is a risk amount to it, particularly when you get into commercial properties, I would say. We put it in Hillsboro, we purchased it in Hillsboro, which is different than Central Oregon in the sense that it's got a longer-term, stable economic
base. Ironically, I think the areas that representative would like to see invested in is probably underserved areas of the state, right? I mean, one would hope that...
Absolutely the case. I mean,
not necessarily the Hillsboroughs and Vance, but...
I mean, I go back to the, many people are dealing primarily with the environmental issues surrounding brownfields. I'm dealing with the fact that they end up looking like eyesores in a community that then no one wants to invest in.
Right.
And there are no jobs there. A lot of them sit on commercial property that could be transformed into jobs. Some of them are being used as food cart spots, but that doesn't quite bring in the kind of money that I'd like to see. And when you look at Eastern Oregon, you have the same kind of thing taking place. So I'm just trying to figure out, that's my goal, is to try to find some way. I'm curious about the temporary housing thing. I'd like to hear more about that. But as we look at the what's available out there, both in terms of property, other needs, that's why I brought this forward.
So I have a suggestion.
Okay. Yes.
That doesn't depend on the Common School Fund at all, but is. And so I don't know if we can even talk about it in this task force, since we're supposed to only be talking about the Common School Fund, but I'll pretend that it's involved somehow. So last big session, so in 2013, actually Cindy and I were approached by Senator George about an idea that he had evidently floated previously, having to do with the uncollected refunds on bottles. So refundable bottles, you get them, and some people go down and get their nickel for every dollar or for every bottle, and some people don't.
A lot of people don't.
A lot of people don't, and there's a large chunk of money. Well, we were in the middle of a number of discussions in the legislative session, and so we ended up with Senator George having a little bit more bargaining going on, and so that disappeared from the table, if you will. But in preparing for this meeting, Cindy Wickham was looking up her file, and she came across this article about refunds for the unclaimed refunds for bottles in different states. And this is from 2003, actually, so it's old. I have no idea how many other states are involved at this point in time. But they set this up in a number of states. So Massachusetts, Michigan, and Maine, the three M's, I guess, passed what they, their escheat laws. So there would have to be, since we already have an escheat law in the Constitution, you'd have to figure out how to set this up. But for requiring all or part of the unclaimed deposits to revert to the state.
Now the
obviously, the food people hate this. So the bottlers and the retail folks hate this because right now, anything that doesn't get refunded, they get to keep that money. So Pepsi and Coke and Ross Safeway and all those people get it. So they don't want to give this money up.
How much money are we talking?
We're talking in Michigan, $23.5 million of unclaimed deposits went into a trust fund in 2000 with 75% earmarked to environmental cleanup and recycling programs. Michigan court, big money is at stake. Massachusetts collected $35 million in 2002 and more than $281 million since January 1991 when they put it into place. All of the money goes to the Clean Environment Fund for hazardous waste cleanup and waste disposal and recycling. Michigan, so that was Massachusetts. Michigan was the 33. They don't, those are the numbers that they give.
So we need administrative machinery to set something like this up. You kind of need to...
Well, this guy says Oregon's bottle bill needs updating to see that unclaimed deposits revert to the public, as does much other abandoned property. Lawmakers also need to refresh the deposit law's financial incentives. Blah, blah, blah.
We had some discussion about that last aspect in the 2013 session.
But an unsurprising effect is that Oregon's beverage container recycling rate, although almost twice the U.S. average of 44%, has been declining. It fell from 90% in 1995 to 84% in 2000 and probably still is dropping.
Oh, I don't think that's the case any longer.
Yeah.
We started to see a reverse because we included water.
Yeah. Oh, right. The water bottles. Yeah.
But now that you have the deposit centers, rather than being able to take your bottles back to any grocery store, I wonder.
I think
what
it's declined more.
I think it's.
I don't take mine back, but I put them out on the curb, and somebody else takes them back. I guarantee it.
I think we need to find out exactly whether we've seen an increase or decrease. I got the impression in talking with some of the grocers that, in fact, they were seeing more because those centers were easier to deal with, and you had people.
People don't want to drive. I mean, my experience is
people don't want to.
I don't want to drive there.
I don't want to stand in line there. As you said, putting it out on the curb and having
other folks pick it up.
You have a lot of folks doing that now.
Yeah. So here's the numbers for Oregon in 2002. The Department of Environmental Quality estimates that 1.4 billion deposit containers are sold in Oregon each year. So I'm sure that's higher now because we've got a bigger population and we include more things. That's $70 million yearly at a nickel deposit per bottle or can. About 16%, this is DEQ's estimate, end up in landfills. That's $11.2 million paid by people for whom it is more tempting to toss the containers into the garbage than to collect the deposit. Also unknown, but probably large number of bottles and cans are broken, crushed, littered, or recycled with no deposits claimed. So if you put them in your recycling bin and they get recycled but you don't claim the deposit, they just go to your recycling center, that money still stays with people as well. Who keeps the unclaimed nickels? The state doesn't get a dime. The beverage distributors hold all of these unredeemed deposits, says DEQ. So that was 2002.
I'd like to see that. That was 2002.
Yeah. I mean, that article was actually 2003, they were taken to court by the people who were unhappy about it, the distributors and the bottlers, but they won consistently in court. There was one lower court that found in the favor of the distributors and bottlers, but the appellate courts overturned them. So there's case law, not in Oregon, obviously, but around the nation to support the fact that those belong to the public. So just as a concept, and I mean, you need to do more work, but it takes it away from the realm of having to worry about, well, what, how do you make the money that's required for the Common School Fund, but gives you an ongoing source of funds for things, and in that case, almost all of the states, it appears, dedicated them to environmental issues. And so so Brownfield's redevelopment would be right in line with that.
Very interesting idea.
Yeah.
What I want to eliminate as an option before we go any further, though, is whether there's a sense that there are things that could be, that the investment portfolio is full right now of what could be used within the investment. I mean, Trisha's comments regarding whether we would get more investment, whether we would get more investment via the Business Oregon or wherever versus something else. If the competition is such for that kind of money, then it doesn't work. And I want to know why. If not why, but if there is nothing else there that we could use, then I'd like to know that. I mean, are there, I mean, you mentioned in the commercial properties aspect, is there any other way that we can make more money via what we have right now?
I mean, currently we're, the Oregon Investment Council with PERS as well as with the Common School Fund has done a tremendous job of earnings for the state.
That's
and
true.
So competing with that is a challenge. I think that it's worth it having a little bit more conversation with the Secretary of State's office and Regional Solutions in terms of their interest in workforce housing, to just understand what they think might be a means to have that be an adequately earning, I guess I would say, investment. I make the case, and you and I believe talked about this, Representative Frederick, that there's a lot to be said for the community values, that if you can improve some community values, that's part of education as well. The courts, unfortunately, have never seen it that way. They've really consistently seen that money is money and social values are social values. But I think that that's one way to approach it, is there a contribution to education in more ways than just the finances? But frankly, that's a pretty tough road because...
Well, I understand that, yeah, that it is. When it comes to the school infrastructure, are there other aspects of the school infrastructure that could be part of this? Obviously, I'd love to see.
There's a huge unmet need.
It's
in
huge.
The billions and billions.
Right.
Right.
But at the end of the day, the source of repayment is taxpayers.
Property tax system.
And the taxpayers can only afford so much. I think you'll see proposals this coming legislative session for the state to provide matching dollars,
right,
through general obligation bonds to try and leverage. But again, if we sell bonds, we'll sell them at that 4%, and if they sell bonds, they'll sell at that 4% as well. So I'm not really seeing this particular fund as the right vehicle. I'll just throw out, since you sort of went further afield from just this fund, that the classic source of funding for a lot of projects that don't quite pencil, that are very socially important, is often lottery bonds. And I know that's also what's funding Regional Solutions. So the lottery bond program will have in the neighborhood of every biennium 200 to 250 million. And frankly, it's really up to the legislature how to best allocate that, whether it's some money could go for workforce housing. We have had up to 16 million per biennium for supportive housing that's been included. So I think that really is a great way to do the social good. And the good part is that it's, you don't need to look at the repayment source, because the repayment source is the lottery. So those grant dollars that are carefully placed can make projects more viable than they'd otherwise be for economic development. It's really focusing on what will be the highest and best use of the funds by the legislature and the governor.
Representative
Yes.
Given your interest in brownfields, it might also be interesting to determine, maybe through League of Oregon Cities, how many municipalities are writing grant applications for their funds for brownfield identification and redevelopment. If we have cities leaving money on the table, perhaps because they don't know or don't have the expertise, maybe that's something that the state can assist them with in developing those grant proposals.
Then that's possible. The good news in terms of the brownfields is I've been told that the governor is going to be looking at refinancing one of the brownfields redevelopment funds. So I'm encouraged by that because it got to the end of their, I mean, they had used it up. So legal cities, counties, ports, I've been talking with quite a bit. There's a brownfield development redevelopment conference either next week or the week after that I'm supposed to be at as well. So there's good news working in terms of the brownfields component there. I'm not as concerned. I wanted to just have something there because there was nothing for quite a while. But I understand the governor's coming in. I'm not sure what the figure is, whether it's $25 or $50 million, but something like that. So we'll see what happens with that. If there was an additional way to do this, I'd like to know that. But it's not. I'm not as worked up about it as I was. I know that we have a long list of things we need in terms of school infrastructure. I am curious about, and I know that the financing there is a difficult thing. It would be good to have that list. I mean, I, for instance, would love to see what the impact would be, whether there's a possibility of getting some things regarding earthquake preparedness, those kinds of issues that we continue to struggle with.
There's a task force that was established by the legislature that will be meeting. They've been meeting this summer. One of my staff folks is on it.
And Representative Chuck Bennett's here, and I think he at least is.
Are you on the task force? Or it's
no.
you know more about it than we do, Bill.
Morgan and
you
I
are
between
more
us
than
know a lot.
Okay.
One of their task force's jobs is to put together this master list of need.
Yay.
So I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about that in the coming session.
And in terms of seismic, it's huge.
Yes.
Last I heard, there were 50 schools or so still in the tsunami inundation zone. And that doesn't count all the schools in the valleys that will fall down. So seismic upgrades is, we have had some money for that, but not much. And it doesn't move schools.
Well, and you know, emergency preparedness, whether it's seismic upgrades or not, there are some things that I'm concerned about. That's another issue altogether, but I'd love to find some way to fund a container outside every school that has shovels and blankets and food and water that would be available for any for the community should we have an issue and available for the school. We haven't gotten that yet. That's one of the things that I'd like to see because I've been watching that. I was actually out of town on the spring break quake, but I remember coming back and seeing what happened to the Malala High School and several places in Portland we were concerned about. So that's something I want to see. But I am hearing right now, let me make sure that I'm correct, I'm hearing right now that there are very few, there are no investment loan situations that would really be able to bring in the kind of return that we expect for the am I correct on that?
I think there's that, but you know, also if we have to look at what pool of funds would there be to loan out, and if you strip away the constitutional and if you don't look at the unclaimed property, then what I've heard from you, Mary, is just that it's just a paltry amount and could be negative certain years and could be positive others. So, I mean, yeah, that's part and parcel of the difficulty. But
yeah, I mean, I think that, and that's what I was just going to ask. I mean, it seems to me that if you think about the if you think about what's really available from the Common School Fund in terms of monies to loan, it's actually not that large, because there's a whole legal issue around the unclaimed property because it's not our money.
Right.
And so there's very little that's actually there that could be loaned, and so the question really for you would be to think about, well, what size of a program were you looking for? And if it's more than just a few million dollars, this is really not the place that's going to be able to provide that fund, that funding. And even if it is just a few million dollars, there's a lot of considerations that go into the discussion, so it's not very straightforward. It seems to me like what would be a really important thing to do, and I know that that Regional Solutions are trying to work on that with their Agora program, but is to try and match up the needs in some of these, particularly in the underserved communities, and match up some of the funding opportunities, because a lot of them have been named here that, quite frankly, I don't know anything about, because I just work on the Common School Fund. But I think that's really what's missing, is sort of that matching of the need to the available grants or loan programs that do exist. I didn't have any idea that there was I guess I should have known that there was a school construction loan program. But I do know that it does fall back to always the communities to raise the money to pay off the loans.
We're just the bond insurance company, really.
Right. Heaven forbid you should actually have to pay.
Thank you.
So, and if we did, you know, as Laura says, I mean, you're talking billions of dollars, and the fund is only $1 billion, and that's the majority of that is stuff that we can't use anyway. And so that's, I think it really does limit what it is that would be capable of being sort of the basis of a loan program, and then you would have to work through all of the legal and legislative issues in setting it up. So from my perspective, I think that we'd have to identify a particular area that was small enough that we could use the Common School Fund if we wanted, and then we'd have to work through all of the legal and legislative issues that would have to be worked through in order to set it up.
Well, let me speak to a couple of things.
Okay.
One is that I wasn't looking for a lot of money. I wanted to have at least some money, because at one point the Brownfields amount was zero. I mean, we had nothing to work with, and we needed to have something, and that was part of the effort. The other aspect is, there are, although Business Oregon has been effective on a number of things, there are communities that feel as though they are left out of the Business Oregon component. And small businesses that I work with on a regular basis, both in my district and outside of my district, I spend a great deal of time dealing with complaints from those small businesses, feeling as though Business Oregon has basically let them fall by the wayside. And then there are some new businesses that people are trying to bring in that feel as though they could not get that kind of support. And so that's where they were hoping. Although I'm not sure, you know, the risk factor is another thing altogether. I spent my weekend talking with high-tech entrepreneurs who were minority high-tech entrepreneurs. And one of the things that they run into is high-tech angel investors not believing that there are minority high-tech entrepreneurs. So that's part. And so they when they come forward, they say, well, you know, you can't be real, or you can't be effective, because we don't see enough of you for you to be effective. This is the kind of thing that I'm trying to figure out how we could perhaps speak to. But we need to have a sense of what kind of risk is real, and what kind of risk is created over time for some of these folks, especially some of these minority entrepreneurs, some minority business people, who feel as though they are left out of the whole mix there. So that's one of the ideas that I, one of the concerns that I have. We are, if if we find that there are no opportunities here, I'm going to try to find some other opportunities. But that's what I'm looking for. I'm trying to find some way of getting to some of the folks who are have been left out. And that's part of my role, as far as I can see. But I want, if we look at if the Common School Fund, in whatever segment of it, is not available, then I'll try to find some other things to work with. But this was one of the suggestions that came to me early in the session to look at. I'm looking forward to that report on what the schools report looks like. I would like to know, I'd like to have, and we've talked about it, and you've presented it, but I'd really like to get a sense of what the competition is, 4% versus 8%. I mean, I'd like to know how that works out and whether they're, how that works out over time. Because, again, there are business folks that I know of who would... who struggle just to get any loan, and they don't know why they're having that problem. Regarding this issue here, I think that's an interesting proposal. It's really not. It could be considered the school fund. But it's not really there.
It's not at this point.
No. It's not at this point.
You would
right.
just want to make sure you didn't write it as a street of property.
Right.
Right. Then it becomes something we can't spend.
Right, exactly.
So you'd want to set it up carefully. But otherwise, nobody's getting that money right now except the bottlers and the
right.
distributors.
Right.
And so
I can just see that. See the storm that was created by Bob's.
Absolutely, absolutely. When you read through and you see the legal cases, you can see that people take this. It's a lot of money, and they don't want to leave it to the public. They want to keep it within
right.
their own corporate coffers.
And sure, that's part of the. And since it was written in 2003, there have been a few changes there. So
yeah.
I'd like to take a look at that and see. But I don't think that it fits within the parameters.
No, it does not.
Of what we're dealing with here. Well, I don't have some of that information right now, and I'd like to.
So, what is the information that you would like?
I'd just like to have. I'd like to be able to. Maybe the report that we issue talk. I'd like to issue a report at least
uh-huh.
to say this. We've looked at this. The concerns are related to the investment, the return on investment, and how that is. It would not be as attractive to anyone. So we
and also there is the component about available funds to loan. There's only that small
exactly.
amount
exactly.
of revenue that might be available, even if there was a solution to the return question.
Well, and both of those things. I mean, that's exactly those are the two issues that I'd like to. I think that becomes part. As a result, I don't see this coming out as a series of any sort of right now legislation that could come in there. But it helps. I think it may help avoid in the future
yeah.
folks saying, let's go for this. It doesn't. This it, we now have a better sense of it than what we did. I'd like to be able to put something together on that if possible.
We could figure out a current percentage of the Common School Fund that if all legal legislative, I's were dotted and T's were crossed, could be available. That is going to change over time because as the contributions change over time to the Common School Fund in terms of the investment in earnings being a major contributor, but we could at least have an idea, sort of order of magnitude. This is, and I wouldn't want to put a dollar number to it because that really does change every year. But
look at what pool is there. And then I think, I mean, I don't want to speak for the beneficiaries, but I think it would be interesting also to understand if that money was out for a loan program, what would that mean to the distributions every year to the schools? Because I think that's a fundamental question.
I think that's true, and I'm curious about the percentage. You were talking about the Portland Harbor cleanup funds. What percentage of that is involved in the expenses? Well, I'd like to have a sort of percentage in terms of expenses rather than just the numbers, because as you said, the numbers are going to change over time. Percentage will change, I'm sure, but at least get a sense of what we have right now available.
And again, available is a very relative term.
I understand, and I think we can say that clearly.
What I would propose is the percentage that is not clearly designated as not being available. And then whether or not any of it is available is still open to some legal interpretation, mainly because of the land board's fiduciary responsibility that they have, and the fact that these funds all, whether they're statutory or constitutional, go into the common school fund, and the land board is charged with maximizing the return off of that common school fund. And so, there are those legally who argue that regardless of what the source of the dollar in the common school fund is, you still want to maximize the amount of money that you get off that dollar. And so, so I think that we can clearly say that there are certain pots of what is in the corpus currently that are not available.
Right.
And then we could say the percentage that, depending on which legal opinion you listen to, might be available. And I think that if we decided for some reason to recommend that be made available for use for some socially significant issue, then there would have to be a conversation with legal folks, both the advisor to the land board, but also from legislative counsel on whether or not they really felt that legally was something that would stand up.
Yeah, I think that's a very appropriate way to go with that. I'm not sure. What I'd like to do is I'd like to put together a report and get that to you.
Okay.
And in terms of organizational meetings or more meetings regarding this, I think let me get the report, some sort of report to you first, and then we can find, we're supposed to have something by September 15th. 15th or 14th, what is it?
The 15th,
yeah.
Just about a month away.
Just a month away. Well,
5 weeks.
Terrible thought.
I know. Terrible thought, isn't it?
But so I want to get something to folks there at that
then
point.
Then come back together and decide what to edit and what to adopt.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So let me put together a report and come back. And if we can get some of that, the detail that you were just talking about, that would be very helpful. I think that'll help a lot. At this point, that's all I have.
So when are you thinking about meeting again?
Well, that's I'd like to do it before Labor Day. Is that possible?
It would have to be right before Labor Day for me. My schedule's very booked until that last week.
I'm out all next week for sure. But I will be back.
When can the report?
I've got to work on the report this week, so I'll try to get. I'd like to try to get something to you, perhaps. Can you get what? How quickly could you get something?
I don't know.
Percentage of what could possibly be
the percentage that doesn't represent those things that are obviously not allowed to be.
So why don't I try to get something to you there? It would be the week of the 17th?
18th,
yeah.
Okay, that would be great. And that would give us and then if we met towards the end before Labor Day.
Right.
Not Friday, preferably, but.
No, not Friday.
Nice. So that's the week of the 25th.
Yes, right. So that would give us 1 week to get the report digested, if you will.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Sometimes, it's a matter of getting ideas out there and seeing what they look like. So That's what I like. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Okay.
We will adjourn.
Good job on that chairmanship thing.
Thank you.
Good job on that chairmanship thing.
Thank you.